From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear from a union member after Act 10 was overturned, restoring collective bargaining rights to Wisconsin union workers. We'll speak with filmmaker Whit Stillman about his first film, Metropolitan, that earned him an Academy Award nomination and has since become a holiday classic.
I had been in the film business enough to know that no one would really come forward from the serious film business to back my film, so that I'd have to do it on my own.
Plus, we'll share some tips about how to talk to kids this holiday season and who brings the gifts.
They can decide if they want to keep up that kind of belief about certain things, like uniforms. It would be a really great example, I think. Or if they want to, you know, explain to them, you know, the reality.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. A Dane County judge delivered a major win to Wisconsin union workers this week. The judge overturned Act 10, restoring collective bargaining rights to unions. Former Governor Scott Walker's 2011 law gained national attention and sparked historic protests at the state capitol. Union workers have been fighting the law ever since without success, until this latest lawsuit filed by seven unions last year. Walker has decried the ruling, and he and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss have promised an appeal. Meanwhile, union members like Rocco DeMarc are optimistic about the ruling. He's a second-shift building engineer for an elementary school and on the executive board in Wisconsin for the Service Employees International Union. DeMarc tells WUWM's Chuck Kornbach how he's seen Act 10 hurt local public schools.
It has affected us a lot. When I first started with the district, we did have a one-year contract, so I got a little bit of a taste of what it was pre-Act 10. Once that was expired and we didn't have that contract anymore, we just started seeing things kind of on the decline. Morale kind of went on decline. People that were supposed to get, you know, the jobs through seniority changed a lot through the district's way of hiring people. We don't really have that well of knowledge of the older generation that basically retired due to Act 10.
In other words, some people got frustrated. They decided they were better off retiring.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of people that just were like, once Act 10 started getting in effect, we saw a lot of people retire. 50% of our workforce is basically after 2016.
And how did that affect the district? I mean, younger people have their skills and enthusiasm, but would you argue quite a bit of increase in retirements negatively affected the district?
I think so, just because we need the wisdom of the past to show us the way of the future. The correct way of doing things in the buildings, to know the right and wrong way of doing things.
So remind me then of the status of yourself and other employees. Are you able to do any collective bargaining?
Well, as of right now, the only thing that we can even bargain for was wages, and it was only for the consumer price index, meaning inflation. As inflation goes up or down, that controlled our pay. So if the CPI was low, then we only, I think one year we had like a penny raise.
A penny per hour.
A penny per hour.
So 40 cents for the week, $1.60 for the month.
Yep, for that year. And in order for us to actually ask for any more than that, we had to put it through a referendum.
Right. And did any of those succeed in your 13 years?
We never really asked for a referendum. We thought it was just not worth the risk of putting all that effort into a referendum that we kind of knew that was going to fail.
That inability to do much about wages, how did that affect your ability to help put food on your table?
Like I said, there are some years that we had like a penny raise and it wasn't really helping most of us out. It was just hindering us mostly.
If you could have, what sort of other things would you have liked to have bargained on? Some sort of working conditions or other benefits, if you would have had that power?
Right now, we're extremely understaffed. most of our buildings are pretty much, we're working to the max. Mostly our second shift staff are just having so much to do. We used to have this thing called AB clean, where we clean half the school one day and half the school the other day, and they merged all into one day. So we're having like 2 days worth of work in just one day.
So along comes this court ruling from the Dane County judge. What was your reaction when you heard about it?
When I found out that the decision came down, I was ecstatic. I was happy. I was mostly like in shock when I found that out.
While you were happy, are you guardedly optimistic at all? I mean, the Republicans are promising an appeal and so on. What's sort of your sense of how high should your optimism be at this point?
I think my optimism is very high. I know that the Republicans are wanting to appeal to the higher court, and I feel like we have a high chance of having Act 10 eliminated.
Some of the Republicans are saying it would be a blow to taxpayers. Do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I disagree with that 100%. As city workers, as state workers, we have a stake in this. And the thing is that we work for the people. We don't want to see taxes go up because of our decisions. We want everyone to be in a happy place where the workers can work alongside with the management and everything would be good.
So you're suggesting that a fairer compensation and bargaining situation benefits everybody?
I believe so, because again, we're working for the people of Wisconsin, and we want to see mostly just to be treated fairly. That's it.
If the court ruling from Dane County stands, and we may not know for a few months yet the appeal process, how long that's going to take, is there anything you and your other union members have talked about being able to bargain more frequently for, have a stronger case in bargaining for?
Well, mostly we're hoping to bargain for just a safer environment for all employees, to be treated as equals, just be treated like a human being at this point.
Rocco DeMarc is a building engineer in the Racine Unified School District and a member of the Service Employees Union, also known as SEIU. He spoke with WUWM's Chuck Kornbach. Have you ever had a bad job? You know, the kind of job where you don't make enough money to afford basic necessities, the hours are volatile, and you don't get any benefits like healthcare coverage or vacation time? Well, if you have, you're not alone. A report by the High Road Strategy Center, a research and policy center at UW-Madison, formerly known as COWS, found last year that 40% of Milwaukee residents are working in, quote, bad jobs. Laura Dresser is the Associate Director of the High Road Strategy Center, and she joined Like Effect's Joy Powers last year to look at what they found.
This is really looking at low-wage jobs, which it kind of defines in a couple of ways, but it specifically uses two categories, bad jobs, better jobs. How does this report really define a bad job?
Well, there's always a little art and a little science to deciding where to set a threshold. We use wages, and this is wages for all workers. So if you're a salaried worker, your wages would be turned into an hourly wage given the report on the number of hours you work. So it's all workers, and it's not just workers with hourly wages. I think that's really important to be clear about. So we look at all workers, and we turn it into the hourly wage equivalent. And then we do a cutoff at $15 an hour and just try and compare the set of jobs that are paying up to that threshold of $15 an hour and those jobs that are paying above. You could move that a dollar or two in either direction, but what you're really seeing is what's going on the in the bottom of the labor market is quite substantially different from what's going on in better jobs. And if you want to really think about how to improve jobs, you have to look at that category of the jobs at the bottom of the labor market. And we set the threshold at $15 an hour.
One of the things that seems to unify a lot of these, you know, quote, bad jobs, where you're making at $15 an hour or under, is not just that they have low wages, but a variety of other things that, really make them harder to live your life outside of work. So what are some of the things that we see associated with these kinds of low-wage jobs?
You know, absolutely. I think that's one of the key points here is you can set the threshold on a wage, but when you're looking at these lower wage jobs, what you're also seeing is jobs that very rarely come with health insurance through employment. So less than half of workers in $15 an hour or lower jobs are getting health insurance through their employer, but 80% of workers on the other side of the threshold are getting health insurance through their employer. So the first, it's much weaker benefit structures, the health insurance being the most central and critical one, especially we all know kind of much more after a pandemic how important health insurance is, but it's also indicative of the way other sorts of benefits sort by wages, so that paid time off, paid family leave, et cetera, the entire question of benefits is quite different at the bottom of the labor market than in better jobs. But a second way is really in the distribution of hours of work. And this means that for some of these jobs, there's quite high demand, and workers get, you know, mandatory overtime and called in a lot. For some workers, though, it's very spotty, so that it's sort of on demand. That is, if the employer has a lot of demand, a lot of people have come to the restaurant, you keep your shift, you get your hours. But if, you know, there's construction or bad weather and people don't come in, the worker takes the hit in wages and gets sent home. That kind of volatility in scheduling means that these, you know, these jobs with low wages in the first place have much less reliability, much more volatility in their wages.
Sure. Now, as we look at Milwaukee as a whole, how many people are working in these low wage, bad jobs?
So we looked at people who live in the city of Milwaukee and looked at their work. So this isn't people who work in the city of Milwaukee, which would be a different sample, but this is people who live and wherever they work, what are they earning? And so that we found about 240,000 workers, 100,000 of them are earning 15 or below, and 142,000 of Milwaukee workers are earning above that threshold. 4 in 10 of workers that live inside Milwaukee City, wherever they work, they're earning 15 or less per hour.
So about 40% of all people who are working and living in the city of Milwaukee are in these kinds of jobs.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff to get into inside of this report. You looked at how union membership has been halved since 1979. I should say the numbers in this report, I believe, are from 2019. So 1979 to 2019, union membership has halved. Racial inequality has risen as a result of this. You also look at manufacturing jobs, the ways in which they have lessened over time. And to me, that really gets to the key industries that we're looking at. Where are we finding the majority of these bad jobs?
Yeah, the dramatic growth and the kind of industries of where the bad jobs are really is are the service industries, especially low-wage service industries. And, you know, this is food service. This is, you know, hotels and entertainment venues. This is retail trade stores and shops, but also education and healthcare and social assistance. You know, they're on net, the jobs are better quality, but there are so many healthcare and social assistance jobs. There are a lot of very low wage jobs in that sector as well. The hands of caregiving, The people who prepare food, the people who serve us and sell things to us, these are the sectors that have grown really dynamically and replaced that manufacturing job base that used to define Milwaukee. They are sectors where job quality is really low, especially arts and entertainment, food service and retail, really low job quality, volatile hours, and a really hard way, you know, as you said, it's a hard life that that job structure creates for, especially for families, people with kids, the volatility and the hours, the unpredictability, the lack of insurance, all of that makes, you know, day-to-day living with a family really hard.
Now, of course, something that the report doesn't get too into, but does talk about a little bit, is this idea that manufacturing jobs were also once considered, of course, very low wage jobs, but also had few protections. They were transformed through unions. Do you see any of that playing out right now as it comes to things like the service industry in particular, where we have seen some places, like specifically coffee houses, attempting to unionize to create better hours, to create more rights for workers?
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting moment. And I really appreciate you noticing that point we make about manufacturing. You know, I think sometimes when you're on this side of, you know, manufacturing loss and deindustrialization, it's easy to forget that at one point, everybody thought those were inherently low wage, dirty jobs. And really, it was unions and the demands of workers for better work that that helped transform that into some of the engine of the middle class of the Milwaukee post-World War II period. And so, as you say, you can kind of see this sparks of this in the increased attention to organizing. You know, nationwide this year has had more organizing, but in Milwaukee as well. And as you say, coffee houses, also Pabst Theater Group and the workers at the Pfizer Forum. And we feature some of these workers who have worked in hospitality or food services all their lives and never realized what it would mean to have union representation in those jobs. And now they do. And I think they're spreading the increasing attention to what you can do with job quality with unions and the increasing impact of that is a really exciting story that's going on in Milwaukee, in spite of, you know, living in a right to work state and, you know, the pressures against unionization. There's still a lot of activity going on.
As you mentioned, you feature voices from people who are working these jobs, people who have worked these jobs all of their lives. And I think people listening to this conversation might be surprised by parts of it, especially the volatility of hours. And when looking at the report specifically, the fact that many of these low-wage workers aren't able to get enough hours. And I think it's surprising because anyone walking into Target, into Walmart, into the many stores that we might go into in our community, restaurants, they all seem to be looking for employees. But when you talk to the people who are inside of these jobs, they really clarify why they don't have enough people to work there.
Yeah, that's such a good point. They really do talk about what makes the work hard. Some of these jobs are really defined by seasonality. And so the worker is having to figure out what the alternate place of work is because that venue isn't open all the time or whatever. And so the volatility is in the structure of the venue. But it's also the case that the model of employer kind of flexibility to employer need in these jobs, you know, has been increasingly established across the last decades. And it is true that workers can get a lot more hours in retail and food service these days. There's no doubt the balance of power has tipped towards workers. Workers can demand more. They can ask for steadier schedules because it's harder to find workers to work in these jobs. But still, the benefits haven't changed, and the conditions of the work and the presumption of and structures of supervision sometimes are so negative that workers just, it's very hard to stay around in the jobs, as some of the quotes in the article point out.
Now, for better or worse, we're seeing more and more jobs inside of these sectors that have these low-wage, bad jobs. What do you see as the future of this area, especially, as you say, with a worker shortage, workers asking for more rights inside of the workplace, less volatility? Do you see things changing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a very tight labor market nationally right now. And we have in the state of Wisconsin a structural kind of shift of the baby boom out because we're a aging state relative to other states. So we even have more underlying demographic kind of shift that will continue to keep the demand for workers high, probably. And I think one thing that it's interesting to see in this tight labor market that I think we haven't seen previously is the way that especially workers at the bottom of the labor market have asked for more, demanded more, moved jobs to get paid more. So wages have moved up at the bottom of the labor market, but it's hard to know how sustainable that is. So I think the first thing that really changes these jobs is the workers themselves. And we've seen a lot of both collective and individual and formal and informal approaches to changing this work. And you see that in the wage trends. The other thing is policy around these jobs, especially to make that rebalancing more sustainable, to think about the policy around the minimum wage and its enforcement in the state. You know, we're surrounded by states with higher minimum wages, except with the exception of Iowa. You know, every state on our border has increased their minimum wage well above the $7.25 that Wisconsin is at. And thinking about how you encourage or support union organizing really matters in this area. So I think there's some public policy choices in addition to the private action of workers that we're seeing that is doing so much.
All right. Well, we will see what the future holds. Laura, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Dresser is the Associate Director of the High Road Strategy Center. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about their report on bad jobs in 2023. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll share some tips for parents about how to talk to kids about Santa Claus. But first, Academy Award-nominated filmmaker Whit Stillman joins us to talk about his 1990 film Metropolitan ahead of a special screening at the Oriental Theater. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Metropolitan is a film that came out in 1990, showing the lives of a group of New York preppies during the debutante season. It's an ironic and comedic look at this group of young Park Avenue socialites who gather nightly to discuss love, honor, and the impending demise of their class. It's also become a popular Christmas film. Metropolitan was written and directed by Whit Stillman, who earned an Academy Award nomination for Best Screenplay for this film, which was his first feature. The film will be showing at the Oriental Theater this weekend as a part of their season screenings program, followed by a Q&A with the director. Ahead of that, Stillman joined me to reflect on the film, starting with what inspired him to center it on the lesser-known world of debutantes.
I originally started preparing a film set in Barcelona about two cousins there that seemed ultimately kind of complicated as a first film and expensive. And I thought, what could I make that would be interesting to some people, if not many people, that could be sort of essentially shot in a room and just people talking and having their lives go on. And so that was the genesis for Metropolitan. And fortunately, I learned along the way that if you got a insurance policy, you could shoot anywhere on the streets of New York. So we opened it up and did a lot of outdoor shooting.
Yeah, we'll get into some more behind the scenes about the shooting soon. But to talk a bit more about the background of this film, you also financed this film by selling your own apartment and also collecting contributions from friends and relatives, and especially being your first feature film. I'm wondering, what was your mindset during that time and what was it about this project that made you comfortable or confident enough to take such a big risk?
Well, I mean, it did seem foolhardy to friends and relatives at the time. I had been in the film business enough to know that no one would really come forward from the serious film business to back my film, so that I'd have to do it on my own. I had started out by selling Spanish films worldwide, and I got to know the Spanish directors of low-budget comedies, and I sort of learned from them how it can be done. And one of them said his cash budget for his film was $50,000. And I had the chance to buy my rental apartment and resell it a year later. There's sort of a cooperative apartment boom in New York then. And the story was that if you could sort of get money to buy your rental apartment and hold it for a year, you could make a profit. And so I saw that I could make $50,000 from buying and then selling the apartment in a year. And so with that in mind, I said, what interesting and pretty and aesthetic story can I do for so little money? And as is the norm with films, it ended up costing a lot more than that, but the money did come in. One friend, a Columbia film grad, who had his own little pile of money to seed money for a film, he worked on a production and was really encouraged by what we were doing. And so he put his money into the film. And they weren't giving presents, you know, they're investing or loaning money, and everyone did really well, thanks to the fact that the film finally became a kind of small hit.
Yeah, and ultimately, this film is a coming of age story and process, even if it's in what might be removed for some audience members, like a debutante New York City setting. But with these characters, it was, I imagine, also kind of a requirement to find some great new actors. You introduced 10 actors in this film, and being an independent film, was this something you had more flexibility and freedom to do, to truly find people that you thought would portray these characters well enough versus, as you mentioned, a studio wouldn't be willing to take that risk to introduce that many new actors?
Yes, you're right. There's a lot of freedom in different ways. I mean, you're sort of struggling with little money and you think you have all these disadvantages, but in fact, some of those are advantages. So with commercial cinema, normally you have to build the story around a couple of important stars. And if you're not doing that, you really have the luxury of having an ensemble of characters. So we sort of have 8 characters who are pretty important in the film. And in retrospect, it turns out it's exactly the right age to get great actors in New York. There are a lot of people who've come out of college or even before college and are trying to make it as actors in New York. And I was advised by the girlfriend of a client I was working with, who is an assistant in casting, about what to do and how to advertise for a casting call. And we must have looked at 800 actors who came in to be considered various ways. And we went through the private schools in New York, but we also had these open casting sessions. But people sort of knew who was right for the film. The first 50 people who showed up for our casting, half the cast comes from that group of people. So they sort of, and I think one of the most important people in the cast, Chris Eigenman, who was, I think, the first person to show up at the casting session. So he sort of knew it was for him.
This film is also very efficient. The takes are quick, as well as the dialogue. So I'm wondering, how long did it take to shoot this?
I think it was 30 days. And I have found actually that when you're tightly constrained in how many shooting days you have, just so you have enough to make something good, it's actually better. I felt sort of when I was indulged, when Castle Rock was backing the films, it got a little sort of lazy and flaccid or self-indulgent in shooting schedules, and that I kind of perform better when it's a tight budget and you're worrying about money coming out of your pocket.
You mentioned you had worked in the industry, but you also started off as a journalist and wrote for several publications over the years. Do you think your writing style for film was impacted by this work, or do they feed each other, vice versa?
I was a really unsuccessful and unprolific journalist. I don't really have a logical, analytical mind, and so it was a huge struggle. And I was also stymied trying to write fiction because I could only write in a sort of silly first person character, and I'd have to do a framing mechanism to explain the silly first person. And what I found with dialogue that was really liberating was the fact that all the people are speaking first person and they're all not the author. So you don't have to explain how it's not you. It's not you, it's an actor on the screen. And so it was very liberating comparatively. I mean, I still find it very hard to write anything, but it was very liberating form.
I imagine it was quite the feat for your first film for you to not just be the writer, but director and producer. And as you've made a few other films, have you discovered a preference of being a director versus writer?
Yeah, everyone prefers to be a director. No one that I know of prefers to be a writer than to be a director. Maybe Woody Allen or someone. But everyone wants to direct and no one wants to particularly write. And for good reason. I think there's more anguish in the writing process to get it right. And I'm really unprolific in films. And people say, oh, you're not getting the financing. And yes, it's true, you're not getting the financing and it's hard to get the financing. But I think it's more that it's rare that there's some story or some script that I feel total confidence in. It's worth really making and going through that sort of process. I mean, there is an agonizing thing in making a film as a director where you feel sort of like everyone's relying on you and you could really flop and you could die before you finish and that kind of pressure. But that's sort of easier to take than the sort of the void of no ideas or bad ideas that you have as a writer.
That's interesting insight because this film, you know, your first one out of the gate, it did earn you an Academy Award nomination for Best Writing. And I imagine that was probably overwhelming to receive for your first film. Did this impact how you saw the industry or shape what you thought laid ahead in your career as a filmmaker?
Well, I had a really negative attitude towards the Academy Awards and the Oscars until I got nominated. And then I decided it's really not so bad. I think one of the most fun things in my entire career was to go to the nominees luncheon for the Oscars, which is like incredible. Like a friend of mine, or a friend I made actually in that process, he was nominated for adapted screenplay. I was nominated for original screenplay. So we weren't competing with each other. And he sat next to Jack Lemmon in his luncheon, and Jack Lemmon told him all kinds of interesting things that were really kind of liberating. And so that was a really wonderful thing. But I am very cynical about or skeptical about the whole awards thing. It's kind of a whole marketing world, and we were very lucky to sort of get in under the wire before the big money went into awards campaigns. The only campaign we had for the nomination was just a letter from our distributor to the writers branch. And the fact that the film had played for 7 months and had a really long run in New York, where there are a lot of writers branch members, meant that we were considered. Otherwise, we wouldn't have made even the nomination level.
It is really interesting to hear some of the background of how that comes together. And, you know, speaking of cynicism, a lot of characters are constantly battling this, right? And one of the lines that stood out to me is, I can't stand snobbery or snobbish attitudes of any kind. Yet this film is filled with characters trying to cover up their own snobbery and insecurities underneath various levels of, you know, who they are, how they operate. And I'll admit, as someone who watched this for the first time, I perhaps felt maybe so insecure or removed from this world that I couldn't get the satiric effect as quickly. So I'm wondering if you can share some of the feedback or reactions that stand out to you, not just when this first came out, but even today as you've been traveling and screening this film.
Well, so the character who says that says it in a very, very snobbish way too. And so, yeah, we're making a joke of that. Actually, the big strategy in writing the script was how to get beyond the fact that people would hate these characters sociologically, that everyone would come at it with a chip on the shoulder or resentment. So how do we get through people's hostility to the milieu so that they can enjoy the film ultimately? And so there are various ways of doing that. One is to have an introductory character who is not ostensibly part of that world and not familiar with it, he claims. In a normal film, he would sort of show them off and denounce them and convert them, and he would win and they would all be humiliated. But we sort of did the opposite in the film, where he's sort of shown to be a bit of a fraud and kind of a two-dimensional character in certain ways. And then I think ultimately, like maybe half an hour in, 40 minutes in, people can kind of drop whatever their social preconceptions are and begin to enjoy the film for what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think the reviews helped us in the sense that they recommended the film, but they also said that, you know, all they do is talk and you won't like these people. So people went in with a kind of proper low expectations. And it's not that purely talking. I mean, there is some other stuff. There is some music. There is some walking around and looking at New York during Christmas. And we've sort of played this thing that it's a Christmas movie because it is set during Christmas and we have some nice Christmas moments. And the kind of good luck charm we had in the shoot was, I knew a professor who was part of this congregation of a church in New York called St. Thomas Church, which had a beautiful Christmas service that everyone liked to go to because it was so beautiful musically, such a spectacle. And so we thought, gosh, if we could shoot that in the film and have it in the film, it'd be just such a coup, such a production coup. And so I went there before Christmas. We talked to the verger, and I think his nice way of saying no was saying, you can shoot here on Christmas Eve for our service, but you can't have lights. But actually the cinematographer after this meeting said, oh, this is fine because I don't need lights. We have really fast films and fast lenses. And so we shot that scene. And so being able to tell people we'd shot in St. Thomas Episcopal Church was sort of an open sesame for getting permission to shoot in tough locations.
Well, Whit, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to talk about Metropolitan ahead of your screening here in town. I appreciate it so much.
Thanks very much.
Whit Stillman is the writer and director of Metropolitan, which will be showing at the Oriental Theater this Sunday, December 8th, with Stillman in attendance for a Q&A after the film. You can find more information and an extended version of our conversation with more behind-the-scenes insight at WUWM.com. In about 10 minutes, we'll bring you the latest Bulber Talk. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz looks into what's happening around the lagoon in Veterans Park. But first, some parents may be hearing this question this holiday season. Is Santa real? We'll share some tips on how to navigate these conversations next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. A quick warning to our listeners, if there are any young kids in the room who are looking forward to Santa visiting this holiday season to drop off presents, you may want to tune out for a few minutes. All right, the kids gone? Many of us remember the moment we found out the big man dressed in red isn't actually the person delivering presents to our homes on Christmas. For some, that truth is no big deal, but for other kids, it can be upsetting. If you're a parent, caretaker, or anyone with small kids in your life, you may be helping keep the mythical magic of Santa Claus alive. But what do you do if a child finds out what they believe isn't real, or if they start asking questions? To help offer some guidance, I'm joined by Maya Harris, a mental and behavioral health consultant at Mayfair Pediatrics Children's Wisconsin. So the myth of Santa Claus is something that a majority of children have grown up with, but inevitably a parent will have to break the truth to their kid eventually, whether just circumstantial or the kid asks, is Santa real? And it's a predicament, right? Deciding how and what to tell kids.
Yes, definitely. Definitely a predicament. I would start by saying, I guess first it's really up to the parent or caregiver to decide if they want to even bring up the topic. Obviously, depending on what your religious and spiritual beliefs are, that might not even be something that is relevant or important. But, you know, for others, it's really up to the caregivers to decide. And then once, like you said, we kind of talk about what happens if they find out, you know, the reality of the situation. Yeah, I would say that it's really being, you know, as honest as you can. And the reasons why, you know, so when we're talking about holidays, we're talking about traditions. So this might be a tradition and explaining what tradition means. This is something that I did when I was little. I think this idea of magic comes into play too, like the idea, you know, children often believe in magic and often, you know, they have great imaginations. And so, you know, kind of bringing that up, this is something that I thought would be fun for you, you know, but it really just depends on, you know, what kind of emotions are coming along with it too. Like kids tend to be more, you know, maybe emotional about it. We want to honor their emotions about it.
Right. And do you think we maybe don't give kids enough credit to recognize when they sense something is off, or if they're just naturally curious, and maybe the conversation turns into a great thing? Maybe it's not a heartbreaking event.
That's true. Yeah, it could definitely be them coming to their own conclusion, like, oh, okay, well, somebody else is giving me these gifts, and it might not even, you know, occur to them as emotional. It might just be you know, okay, that's fine. And they can move on. So it just depends on the child, right? And the context and how they're learning, if they end up learning that Santa is, you know, not real. So,
yeah. To go into a bit of the deeper side of it, I mean, ultimately, it's keeping up a lie as you move along. Some parents take it to various degrees, of course. But do you think keeping up the myth of Santa can harm a child's psychology?
You know, I don't have any studies to reference the latter, so I would say no. I mean, it's the same thing as watching a movie that has, you know, mythical characters in it, right? Are those mythical characters real? Again, depending on what the parents and caregivers decide to explain to their children, you know, they can decide if they want to keep up that kind of belief about certain things, like unicorns. It would be a really great example, I think, or if they want to, you know, explain to them, you know, the reality. So I don't know of any harm that's been done. What I did want to also incorporate was that if parents too choose to tell their children that Santa is not real, to be very respectful of other people at school. Because I remember growing up, what ends up happening is, yes, there's somebody that may know the truth or may know the latter. So I don't believe in Santa Claus, but that's fine that you do believe, right? So it's really just being respectable and saying, you know, you don't believe in this or we don't believe in this, but somebody else might. And that's okay. You know, we all have our own different beliefs.
So one argument for keeping up the myth is that if kids don't grow up with this tradition, it will deprive them of Christmas cheer, of the holiday spirit. How do you address this?
Yeah, let's talk about, you know, so the connections with Santa and just in general, religion, spirituality, celebration is that there's more to those things, right? So it's more than just giving and receiving gifts, right? Because I feel like Santa's kind of connected to more like the gift receiving more than giving, but there's some giving involved. But what else, if we kind of look at the whole of celebration, holiday season, those kind of things, what else are we doing? You know, so some things that came to mind that I wanted to just talk about was togetherness, as well as joy and peace is talked about sometimes, but just trying to be more selfless too, right? We want to, you know, give to others, think about others. So yeah, I think those kind of conversations can be really helpful and important.
Definitely. One big thing I did want to talk about is the use of Santa Claus as a motivational tool, like as a way to enforce good behavior. You know, kids are always told, like, you got to be good, otherwise you won't get presents from this person who will come during the night. So what are the ethics in essentially using this as a manipulative parenting strategy? Do you see it that darkly, or, you know, what can be the steep slope that people can go down?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, we do have the ability as parents and caregivers to provide our children with incentives. Positive reinforcement is what we like to talk about it as. But I think that, yeah, it could be a slippery slope. And again, can we talk about traditions and celebrations in a different kind of way, as opposed to just good or bad behavior, right? I think if anything, in society, there's certain expectations that we have about our behaviors, that we should be acting and behaving in certain ways. Nothing wrong with that, right? It's just a matter of the context in which we're talking about being good or bad. And we probably shouldn't be saying good or bad either. We should be just focusing on, you know, how can we get along better together? How can we manage our emotions? It's really about managing our emotions and coping with our emotions better, right? So if a child had a bad year, maybe a lot happened in that year. Maybe they've been struggling a lot. Probably shouldn't put weight on whether they should get gifts or not based on that. You know, it's just more about how can we help you to have a better year or have a better month with your emotions and things that's going on. So yeah, I would say let's try not to put too much weight on the gift giving and spend more time talking about celebration, again, togetherness, and you know, how we can do for others.
On the note of this reframing of how we operate and see this time of year, you know, another big factor is some parents try to avoid the big Christmas idea or Santa Claus because perhaps there's financial constraints, or like we said, there's a lot has been happening this past year, these past few years for everybody. But kids, they can easily play the comparison game, you know, with their schoolmates, with their friends, and maybe they feel badly if they're not getting the same gifts as others or bigger or better. So that's a hard thing to navigate too. How would you suggest parents can help kids understand things in a different way, to not try and look outwards and compare what they have in their Christmas traditions versus others?
Yeah. Well, again, I think it kind of goes back to, you know, everybody's different and everybody celebrates different things. So, you know, a child might be in a classroom where not everybody's celebrating Christmas, right? And that's maybe confusing for them. So having those conversations that everybody celebrates different things, some people don't celebrate. And so what we do is different from somebody else, but it's okay to share what your traditions are, what you like. And again, be able to understand that if somebody's doing something different, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just what fits best for them or what works for them. I did want to add that the holidays, I guess, and not necessarily something to, you know, broach with younger children, right? But, you know, we're centered around feelings of joy and togetherness during this time of season. But there are people that do struggle in this time of season. So again, just being mindful that some people have not had the best experiences. So recognizing that maybe not everybody is, like you were saying, in their particular situation, the most joyous during this time of year, and just being aware of that. But that hope that we can incorporate some of these ideas of togetherness and celebration throughout the year, right? Not just at this time.
Maya Harris is a mental and behavioral health consultant at Mayfair Pediatrics Children's Wisconsin. We spoke in 2022.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Susan Bentz. Loads of people enjoy Milwaukee's lakefront, including Shorewood resident Margaret Barron. She soaked up Bradford Beach with her daughters, and years later, the Veterans Park Lagoon with her grandchildren.
We did. We used to go to the lagoon and rent the boats, the swan boats.
So when the lagoon suddenly looked dramatically different, Barron noticed. A striking number of trees along the east side had been removed.
It happened very suddenly. I mean, it was quick. I would say within less than a year, they had died. And we wondered if it was, did the water level rise? Were there some kind of bugs?
It turns out bugs were to blame, and the problem's been festering for years, according to Peter Bratt. He's Milwaukee County Parks Director of Operations and Skilled Trades.
This side, the east side of Veterans Lagoon, at the question of mention, has a lot of dead ash trees. And we've, you know, since 2011, Milwaukee County just been hammered with the emerald ash borer.
The invasive metallic green beetle has eaten the life out of countless ash trees in Canada and the U.S., including right here in Milwaukee, next to the lagoon.
So we removed about 2.7 acres of trees, at least 50.
Four willow trees were also removed. Brett says they had died of old age and were in danger of falling. Where the trees once stood now looks like storm-ravaged terrain, but it's just a drop of the lagoon story. Milwaukee's lakefront was created as part of a massive landfill project starting in 1907. The lagoon was initially a coastal bay connected to Lake Michigan. In fact, people enjoyed swimming there. By the early 1960s, the lagoon was cut off from the lake as Milwaukee County began filling 100 acres, which eventually became Veterans Park.
It really became a detention or retention pond for stormwater that is directed here from the street grid around it.
That's Sarah Toomson, Milwaukee County Parks Assistant Director of Planning. Still, the lagoon remained popular for fishing, paddleboarding. It even hosted a water ski show and dragon boat festival, until Toomson says.
The water quality of the lagoon has been changing over time, and we'd consider it now hyper-eutrophic.
If that sounds bad to you, it's because it is.
It's really unhealthy for the habitat that's within and around it.
Researcher Todd Miller has been at the forefront of figuring out what's going on in the lagoon. The UW-Milwaukee public health professor discovered, with his students, concerning concentrations of algal toxin in the water.
So we worked with county parks and the health department, and we got the signs out, and we limited recreation that would potentially result in accidental ingestion. I mean, that's the thing with these toxins, is that you really have to ingest them.
This particular blue-green algae is toxic. It can cause flu-like symptoms, rashes, respiratory distress. Miller says his research found the leading cause of the toxic algae is coming from the lagoon itself.
The bottoms, the sediments in the lagoon. And those nutrients have just built up over decades.
Milwaukee County Parks is now working on a fix thanks to a $300,000 Great Lakes Restoration Initiative grant. Listener and lakefront fan Margaret Barron shares her hopes for the lagoon.
I would like to see it cleaned up and maybe even some type of fish that kids could fish. That would be a wonderful thing in conjunction with the swan boats. But you'd have to be real sure that the fish were safe, or maybe just catch and release.
Like Margaret, you can keep an eye out. There may be more changes coming to the lagoon.
Support for Bubble Talk comes from Palermo's Pizza and Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/BubblerTalk to submit your question.
And Bubbler Talk wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and Excret Nunez join me producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Taryn Powell, Chuck Kornbach, and Mayan Silver from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarra-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.